Good afternoon, and welcome to the statewide Grand Rounds provided by the New York State Office of Mental Health's Bureau of Psychiatric Services. I'm Dr. Jay Carruthers, Director of the Bureau, and I'll be your host for this presentation, which is entitled Global Developmental Epidemiology in a Digital Age. The New York State Office of Mental Health is accredited by the Medical Society of the State of New York to provide continuing medical education credit to physicians. We select our topics and develop the content of each program with OMH psychiatrists and physicians in mind. We also welcome viewers from other mental health service systems and professions and hope that these programs will be of benefit to you as well. I want to remind you that the slides for today's program and additional resources are available at the OMH internal CME website. You may also use this internal website to view archived videos of previous statewide Grand Rounds. Please note, you must be a New York State OMH employee to access the secure site. The website address is listed at the bottom of the screen. If you're not an OMH employee, don't despair. You can still view the archived programs. These videos are posted to the New York State OMH external website 2 to 3 weeks after the live broadcast at the web address listed at the bottom of the screen. We'll open our phone lines toward the end of the program and invite your questions via our toll-free number. Please give us a call. Your questions always enrich the program. You may also email your questions to us at any time during this program, and we'll address them throughout the show. Our email address is swgr@omh.ny.gov. All of the faculty and planners associated with this activity have indicated that they have no financial arrangements or affiliations with any commercial entities whose products, research, or services may be discussed in these materials. Any discussion of investigational or unlabeled uses of a product will be identified. We're pleased to welcome to our program Dr. Helen Edgar, Chair of the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and Director of the Child Study Center at NYU Langone Medical Center. Welcome.
Thank you, Jay. I'm delighted to be here and to be here with Bruce.
And we also like to welcome our very own Dr. Bruce Hasek, the Associate Executive Director at Rockland Children's Psychiatric Center and Clinical Associate Professor of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at the NYU School of Medicine. Welcome, Bruce. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jack.
Okay, on to today's program. In today's program, we explore the power of advances in digital technology when paired with developmental epidemiology and data science. Less than 20% of children with disabling psychiatric disorders receive any treatment. Even fewer receive an evidence-based treatment. But with the proliferation of smartphones among the general population, we have an opportunity to intervene much earlier and reduce disability on a population level. So our learning objectives for today's program, at the conclusion of the program, participants should be able to, number one, describe the challenges in providing access to mental health care for young children. Number two, explain the role of developmental epidemiology in pediatric population science. And number three, identify opportunities for use of digital technology in national and international mental health. And now we'll turn things over to Dr. Edgar.
Good. Thanks so much, Jay. So I'm really thrilled to have the opportunity to be here. And I wanted to start by saying that I like to sort of think of this talk as being seeing the unseen. And that's going to have a lot of different meanings that I'm going to reference as we go through the talk. First is the whole issue of early childhood mental health and recognizing that in very young children, preschool children, that has not been seen. I think the second thing is, as you mentioned, that very few children get mental health care. So that is often an unseen problem, that we see so many kids, but there's so many more who don't get care. And then specifically, I'm going to be talking about how we can use video in particular to be able to identify problems and see things in a new way. So I'm going to start with a story that I think really frames the issues that I have been addressing my whole career. So here is a picture of my twin boys, who are now 15 years old. There is Oliver and Leo, Spider-Man and Batman. And one, this picture shows how children have such amazing imaginations to be able to be in different worlds. But it's really for me to tell you a story about a soccer game of 4-year-olds, which is a pretty difficult thing anyway. So we were at a soccer game with my twins, and there was this little boy there who was just out of control. He was kicking the other children, lying down on the field, climbing the goalposts, and he was getting yelled at by his parents and the coach and really disrupting the game. But when we got into the car, Leo, one of my boys, said, "You know, Mommy, everybody thinks that he's a bad boy, but he's really a sad boy." And that, even telling that story now, it moves me to think that this young child was able to really access and see the emotional experience of this child while the grown-ups were only focused on the behavior. So video has played a really, really important role in the field of infant mental health, which is really infant preschool mental health is the mental health issues and care of children from infancy. Usually we say to age 5 or to age 6. But in early days of the field of infant mental health, where people didn't even think, well, at that point, that babies could experience pain, much much less emotions like sadness, Renee Spitz, who was an early researcher, did some amazing videos, very upsetting videos, of babies who had been separated from their mothers for long periods of time, about 6 months of time. And he identified that these young children became very withdrawn and actually with autistic-like symptoms that he called anaclitic depression. I'm going to show you briefly what these babies look like. These were all babies who started out looking like typical. These were all healthy newborns at birth. So what you see is this child is very withdrawn, has very stereotyped behaviors, and it's a pattern, a very upsetting pattern that we see similar to children who've been very deprived, for example, in orphanages and other places like that.
Like the Romanian.
And I actually was involved in the Bucharest Early Intervention Study, and really what one amazing thing is that those kids present with autistic-like symptoms, which then resolve when they are taken and put into a family situation.
Right.
And
yeah.
So it's that's a sort of an interesting example. So the second one here is something called the still face paradigm. And what this is something that has really taught us about attachment and the nature of parent-child relationships. So in this paradigm, the mom starts by playing with her child and looking at the child, and then she turns away and turns back with a blank face, which is very similar to the experiences that babies and children have when they have a depressed mom, actually. And what you see is a pattern of behavior of this child trying to engage her mom, pointing, reaching out to her. And I'm unfortunately not going to be able to show you the whole video, but what happens over time is that she starts giving up. And even when the mom turns back and is engaged, she actually averts her eyes for a while. So again, it's to show how the nature of children's experiences and the nature of their bond with their parent really affects not just their behavior, but their emotions. Now, here is a sort of a fun fact that I wanted to add to show that I come to this area from a long history. So on the left, or on the side in the white dress, that's a picture of me with my mom. And on the other side is Margaret Mahler, who was one of the early infant psychiatrists, she's a psychoanalyst, but who did videotaping of children. Both children who were disturbed, but she had a nursery of typical children, and I was a Margaret Mahler baby. Margaret Mahler there is holding my sister Jenny. So when I knew I wanted to go into the area of infant mental health, we really hadn't made a lot of progress in terms of, I would say, really the science of being able to say, do young children present with psychiatric disorders that are similar to those at older ages? How common are they? And this is on quote here in the slide, which I'll read to you, which was advice given to me by one of my dear mentors, Bob Emdy, who really set me on the course of data I'll be presenting today. And he said, if you can bring the methods and rigor of developmental epidemiology together with infant mental health, you will move the field forward. And that's really the work that I and my colleagues, I was at Duke before I came to NYU, have been doing. So what is developmental epidemiology? It's really a combination of psychiatric epidemiology, which is understanding the presentation course, correlates, et cetera, of psychiatric disorders in populations, with developmental psychopathology, which is understanding psychiatric symptoms and disorders from a developmental perspective, basically from infancy all the way into late life. I'm not going to go into the details of that square there, but that square represents two decades of work that I did at Duke, and is the series of studies, population studies, that our group did and now have been replicated nationally and internationally to be able to address that question, what is the prevalence of psychiatric disorders? And so these are community studies, because you can't study these things with kids who come into a clinic, because that's a very biased sample. So just to give you a sense, these are large studies. So for my preschool anxiety study, we screened 5,000 parents, did interviews in the home with 1,000 parents, and then brought 500 kids into the lab, and then we did neuroimaging with another 250. So, you know, these are intensive studies, but it's what needs to be done to move the field forward. And that really leads into this idea that knowing about things is what is going to enable us to see them. So one of the first conclusions, kind of surprising conclusions, was we found is that the rate of impairing psychiatric disorders in children 2 to 5 is 1 in 9. Now, what's extraordinary about that is that that rate is the same rate that we find in older children and adults. So we've had this idea of early childhood that it's about risk for later problems. And what our work and others show is it has already begun. Yes, there is risk for later problems, and young children suffer from depression, anxiety, ADHD, behavioral disorders, PTSD, at a rate that is similar and that they deserve care. Now, I am later going to be talking some about autism, and this is not from my work, this is from the Centers for Disease Control, but showing how the prevalence of autism has increased dramatically. The current rate estimates is 1 in 68 children have autism. And what's important epidemiologically here is to show that part of this increase is actually from better ascertainment and measurement. But actually, careful studies have shown that there is also an increase that is, and we're trying to figure that out. I mean, there are environmental impacts, older parents, et cetera, et cetera. So that's really sets that first stage of us seeing, yes, young children have impairing mental health disorders. And that's going to change both how we care for people, but also our public policy. So Bruce, I wanted to turn to you.
Well, I think it's amazing, really. I mean, this 1 in 9 it's extraordinary and it's surprising. And it makes me think how important it is to be thinking with a developmental perspective. We as child psychiatrists do that all the time. Yeah. And I think that it's just as important for adult psychiatrists to be thinking with a developmental perspective across the lifespan from infancy, preschool, school age, adolescence into adulthood. And it's clear that for the kids we're caring for in the hospital and for the adults that are being cared for in the hospital, that these problems started early.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's two things I'd like to just comment
on.
The first is we can think of infant and preschool mental health as being so different, but it's not different, one we've seen because of the rate of disorders. But in fact, a lot of what we do in infant mental health should be applied across the lifespan. This relationship context, understanding the importance of relationships, and understanding development over time. You know, it's really, and what when we say 1 in 9, a key thing is it doesn't mean that all of the disorders have the same rate at every age. Let me give you two examples.
Great.
One,
yeah.
ADHD, which we conceptualize as a neurodevelopmental disorder, the rate in preschoolers, children, adults is around 3 to 5%. It doesn't really change with development, which kind of makes sense, right? While something like depression, in preschoolers the rate is 2%, equal in boys and girls, and then at puberty we see a significant increase in depression that's mostly because the rate in girls doubles. So, and that stays all the way until later life when the male-female prevalence is more like 50-50. So that just gives you an example of how the overall rate is the same, but the pattern of the disorders and what's most prominent may change.
Right. I mean, it makes me think, and maybe we can talk about it later, with this stuff starting so early, where are we putting our resources?
Great, and that is a great segue for me to the next piece.
So she loves when people ask that.
You teed me up perfectly. Right, because early identification improves outcomes.
Yeah.
And, you know, and that's, and I'll give you an example in terms of autism. So a randomized trial of intensive autism treatment that started at age 2, that then at age 5, there was a mean of a 20-point increase in IQ. That is the difference between children needing 100% care to being able to, you know, be productive and have a much more independent functioning life. That's just one example.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a system, to even get into the OMH system, you have to have demonstrated such, high level of psychopathology for years and years, and cycled in and out of community hospitals. It's an acute care system, not just in psychiatry, but across the board. That's sort of diabetes, all these diseases.
Right, but it's already been. I mean, I think there's an example that I do primarily anxiety disorders, right? And so at older ages, there's much more comorbidity. But we find in preschoolers, it's much more common for preschoolers to have one anxiety disorder, not three, or three plus depression. It's a heck of a lot easier to treat one than it is to treat multiple. So, but the sad truth is that few children get the help they need. Jay had mentioned this, but only 25% of children, this is across, this is really actually from 6 to 18, get any kind of any mental health treatment. That means, you know, of all, not just getting to a psychiatrist or a psychologist. And for young children, it's even where it's 15%. And of course, the other thing is that few children actually get evidence-based care, those who are getting care.
Sure.
And let me sort of give you an example of the implications of this in autism. So the mean.
Well, before you go on, I have a quick question about the increased prevalence of autism. You sort of alluded to it. But so, how do we know? How did they tease that out, that it's not just simply increased diagnosis?
Right. So you look at the changes in methods of identification. So, for example, there have been some changes in the diagnostic criteria. So seeing whether moving from when we had Asperger's and PDD-NOS now to this
DSM-4 just to 5,
with just having a spectrum disorder, can we account for this difference as we're counting different noses? Or then looking at what are the methods, right? Are the, you know, are these prevalence rates based on actually state-of-the-art, reliable, and valid diagnoses? Mm-hmm. And so if you can parse out that piece over a period of time, you can say, okay, it meets those criteria. It was well-diagnosed, these things. Then you see if there's a trend that's that there's a difference over time in terms of that. And it has to be done internationally. I mean, most of these studies have been done, you know, not just in the U.S., but, I mean, we're seeing, because if there are going to be risk factors that are increasing autism, like, let's say, air pollution, which seems to be something.
Implicated.
Yes, then you would see that in all the places there's air pollution, right? Not just in one area. So.
Okay, thanks.
No problem. And so we can diagnose at 18 months autism now reliably and validly, but the mean age that a child in the U.S. is diagnosed is 46 months. And here, I'll just say, this is the time when the architecture of our brains is established, right? This is not just a time of learning cognitively, emotionally. The rate of growth in the first few years of life, and now this number is supposedly even higher, but this is 700 synapses a second, and synapses are the connection of your brain cells, so that what happens in early childhood is setting the stage for health and mental health across the lifespan. But now I'm going to turn to something that I'm very passionate about, which is, okay, kids don't get care. How are we going to get people to recognize it? And it's not just doctors, right? Parents need to know, And I call this, When Should You Worry? Right? And so I'm going to show briefly now a little movie from my Autism and Beyond app of parents talking about this.
They all have different personalities.
My first one never threw a temper tantrum ever. My third one does not throw a temper tantrum ever. My second one is king of temper tantrums.
She'll go boneless in a second, just, you know, collapse on the floor.
When she was 18 months, she would say, like, got this, and mama, dada, then all of a sudden she just stopped.
You leave the hospital, and they don't give you any instructions.
With our first child, we were constantly asking, is this normal?
When they don't meet milestones, my immediate reaction is, oh my gosh, what's wrong?
I know it's going to be okay, but I don't know, I just keep worrying.
Everybody worries, but when is it something that is bigger than yourself?
When she was about 6 or 7 years old, we got a diagnosis of autism. And autism can be diagnosed far younger than that. And if my daughter had been diagnosed several years earlier, it would have helped us and calmed our anxiety down to be able to take better care of her.
You just want the best, and we know that research is important.
No one wants to see their child suffer.
I don't want someone else's child to go through something that maybe setting my child a little bit could have helped.
And that's all you can really hope to do, is to make a change today that's going to ripple into another generation.
But worrying, gosh, that's part of the deal. That's part of the package.
I think the main is the love between the parent and the child. This is a really amazing thing for your life.
So one of the things that I want to emphasize here is the man with the blue shirt who said that his daughter got diagnosed at age 7 is a colleague of mine working on the Autism and Beyond app, and he's a pediatrician. So if we think about knowledge gaps, it's extensive. So with this in mind, I'm very passionate about what I call, how do we define the when to worry domains in early childhood? What are the areas parents worry about? Temper tantrums, sleeping, anxiety. And when is it something that is typical of a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old? And when are there indications that it might be clinically significant and that we should intervene? Now, the point that I want to make here is you can only answer these questions with epidemiology. Because if you want to say, here's the range of children with their temper tantrums, you have to have a representative sample of people to be able to define that, right? Because if you just focus on the extreme end, you won't know. So this is one of the key areas. Epidemiology is important around the diagnostic, you know, areas that I emphasize, but it also is an approach that gives us a way to characterize the range of normal, normative presentation, and then empirically, not just guessing off of our heads, empirically define what is the extreme end. And I'm going to illustrate this now with an example about temper tantrums. And I've done a lot of work on temper tantrums and are interested because it's a great example of something that's common in early childhood and can be associated with mental health problems. So here, these are data from the studies that I showed you. And with the green line, this is the frequency of tantrums. So it's 2 years old, 3, 4, 5, and you see what you would expect. Toddlers, 2 and 3 year olds, have more common tantrums, 4 times a week, 5 times a week. And then at age 4, when kids are starting to learn these capacities to control your emotion and behavior, the rate goes down. Now, one thing I'm going to point out here, it is not the terrible 2s. Take this away. It's the terrible 3s. 3 is when dysregulation normatively reaches its peak. Fears are at their peak, aggression is at their peak, and actually temper tantrums are at their peak also. But then on the other side with the blue and red lines is, well, really, is frequency going to be helpful to enable us to make this distinction of when to worry about it? And in fact, when we look at what is happening during the temper tantrums, and this is with aggression and without aggression, we see very different frequencies. Now, first, let me tell you what I mean by aggression here. It's very straightforward. During the tantrum, the child hits, kicks, bites someone else or themselves, or breaks something. So this isn't throwing a pillow. It's not slamming a door. It's taking a cup and smashing it to the ground. So it's, you know, pretty specific type of aggression. So what you see is that there is significant developmental difference in these two type of tantrums. So we'll start with the blue line, which is the non-aggressive tantrums. 2-year-olds Well, they have a mean of 2 times a week, right? Who have are having these non-aggressive tantrums. Now, look, you see the 3-year-olds, look at that, say it's because 3 is this time of change. But then with the 4- and 5-year-olds, you see this significant drop down in frequency. Now, with the red line, those are children with aggressive tantrums. We see that 2-year-olds with aggressive tantrums are having them almost every day, 7 times a week. And again, we've got some difference with the 3s because there's a normative up boost in aggression at that point. But the important thing I'd like to highlight here is that at 5, the 5-year-olds with aggressive tantrums are having them with the same frequency that the 2-year-olds with aggressive tantrums are. So there we can think of that as a marker of some kind of important dysregulation at age 2. But if a kid's still having that at age 5, we can think of that as a failure of development, of developing these skills, these capacities to manage emotion and aggression. So the next thing we looked at is, well, what are the associations between temper tantrums and the most common psychiatric disorders? So on the disorders column, it's ADHD, ODD, which is oppositional defiant disorder, depression, generalized anxiety disorder, separation anxiety disorder, social phobia, and then an overall rate. And what we see here is that non-aggressive tantrums are not significantly associated with psychopathology. And I want to emphasize that here because it's as important to know when to worry as it is when not to worry. Because our goal is not to over-pathologize children, it's to identify the right children. And then these are odds ratios. So the children who have aggressive tantrums, I'm going to point you down to the very bottom for any disorder. Children with aggressive tantrums, 2- to 5-year-olds, are 7 times more likely to have a psychiatric disorder than children without aggressive tantrums. Now, you would think this is going to be something associated with behavioral disorders because tantrums are a behavior manifestation. But what we see is, yes, for oppositional defiant disorder, where tantrums are a symptom, actually it's one of the core symptoms, yes, the odds ratio is big, 27. But aggressive temper tantrums are as strongly associated, not just with ADHD and ODD, with depression, and then with anxiety disorders. And that means that tantrums, rather than being a specific marker of a behavioral disorder, is actually a marker of preschool emotional behavioral dysregulation and distress. It's more like a fever than it is a specific symptom that's going to tell you what the problem is. So here's another way of looking at those data that I just showed you. So on the bottom are the different disorders. This one actually includes PTSD and conduct disorder as well. On the far side are children who don't have a disorder. But scan your eyes across the red lines there. That's the percentage of the children with this disorder who have aggressive tantrums. And what you see is how prevalent and common they are in the emotional disorders, what we call emotional disorders, as in the behavioral disorders.
I mean, it just underscores how difficult it is to tease out diagnostically if you're basing it on emotional dysregulation. I mean, and looking at separation anxiety compared to PTSD, that's pretty shocking those two have the same rates of tantrums.
Well, right, and so what that says is it's so critical that we do comprehensive psychiatric assessments.
Because
you say, okay, here's the symptom, what's the constellation that goes around it, right? For PTSD, it's going to be re-experiencing, but with separation, it's going to be separation. Now, children can have more than one thing also, of course.
Often do if they're in our system.
No, they do. Well, it's the nature of actually, it's more likely to have more than one than not.
Yep.
But I think this doesn't say, it's all one gamush. Yeah. We can't distinguish it. No, it says we can never base things on one symptoms. They are syndromes and constellations of symptoms. But then the question is, well, what happens to these kids, right? And parents who have children who are aggressive are worried actually their kids are going to end up being conduct disordered, that they're on a very bad pathway that way. But in fact, what we found here is our follow-up. So we followed the children who we assessed when they were 2 to 5. We did a follow-up when they were 6 to 9, and then when they were 8 to 12 years old. And what this shows here is that having aggressive temper tantrums as a preschooler predicted this only significant prediction to school age was having an anxiety disorder. You were almost 8 times more likely to have an anxiety disorder when you were in early school age. And then for the 8 and 12 year olds, it predicted with a 5 times greater rate depression. So this is really to highlight the point that, first of all, in child psychiatry, the split that we often have between behavioral disorders and emotional disorders is not particularly useful, number one. And number two, that careful seeing that we talked about really gets to the importance of us really doing proper assessments. And you do an assessment and you make a differential diagnosis, and then you have to really not just get led by one thing and then go down that path, but how critical it is to understand all of the components.
But again, it sort of underscores your point about the developmental epidemiology, knowing the difference that you have higher odds ratios for anxiety at 6 to 9, and then higher from 8 to 12. I mean, really, that's going to help you in that assessment process. That's going to inform.
Well, right. It emphasizes that in caring for preschoolers with aggressive tantrums, we cannot ignore recognition and treatment for the emotional dysregulation, because we'll be missing the boat, right? If we really want to intervene, we need to intervene on the emotional level. And number two, I think it also emphasizes the reassurance you can give parents. Now, maybe it's not reassuring, oh yeah, your kid's at a risk for an anxiety disorder, but really parents worry, like, my kid's going to end up in jail, right? My kid's so transgressive and is so, you know, doing all these bad things. So I think it also gives us compassion for these little people who are, you know, next time you're in the grocery store and there's a parent who's turning beet red while their kid is losing it, you know, have compassion that this is not bad behavior.
Back to the soccer game with your son.
Exactly. Is well, seeing it. The you know, sadness.
No, nobody said it better. Nobody could have said it better than Batman and Spider-Man.
Exactly.
You know, the 4-year-olds on the soccer field.
That's right.
Where, you know, it's everybody thinks he's bad, but really he's sad.
Exactly.
And I think that goes to the heart of the work that we try to do in our inpatient facilities and our outpatient programs in caring for these kids, is to really understand what's at the root of the trouble that led them to come to care to begin with, to understand that bad behavior, that there's behavior and there's emotion. It's both, right? And, you know, so you were talking about tantrums in preschoolers, and I was thinking about tantrums in teenagers.
Right, they're called rages.
Yeah. I mean,
and we call them rages, we call it intermittent explosive disorder, we call it
aggressive behavior.
Aggressive behavior.
We call it defiant, call it oppositional, we call it what brings you to the court, what gets you admitted to the hospital. And you know, the underpinnings of that could be anything, and so often times the understanding stops at the presenting symptom, as if that is the answer itself. You were talking about fever, whether it be fever or cough, aggression presenting to the emergency room, or aggressive behavior in a kid who's admitted to our hospital. Our job is to understand it.
Well, right, and I think, you know, if we think about the relation between emotion and behavior, so we talk about fear, as you know, the basis for anxiety disorders. Sadness is the emotion linked to depression. When we talk about these kind of irritability, aggression, we talk about the behaviors. We don't talk about anger dysregulation. Anger is an emotion, right? But we don't connect to the emotional part. We only look at the result. I happen to hate the name of oppositional defiant disorder because if you look at it, it's about you're opposing something that someone's telling you to do and you're defying it. It's all about your external actions in relation to another person. It's nothing about what is the experience of the internal experience of the child. Yeah. And that then shapes what we do, right? We do behavior programs and things to contain the behavior. And so, it's I think, as you mentioned, actually critical across the lifespan. And the whole study of irritability, which has been an interest of mine for so long, is, you know, that's really, it undergirds so many different disorders and is, you know, very important, particularly for the acute and severe families, patients and families that we take care of.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. I think we're right on time here. So
good. All right. So now I've sort of set the frame and sort of the seeing of both of this issue of mental health disorders in young children, really seeing the rate of it, and then kind of walking through how do we get to that point of having reliable and valid diagnoses, and how do we address the needs of parents. So
I'm going to interrupt you for a second.
Sure.
And you can tell me sort of maybe we can table the answer to this question. But our colleague, Dr. Matt Perkins, I think based on the conversation we just had, said, what are the interventions for aggressive tantrums? And is there evidence that treatment prevents anxiety disorders or other psychiatric conditions? So we can take maybe just the tantrums one because we were...
So I think, you know, the key piece... I mean, I'm giving you a very truncated view of the temper tantrums because there are other aspects that we can identify to identify what is the nature. Like, do they happen outside of the home? Do they happen with other people? Sort of the latency of recovering, et cetera. But, you know, I really think that the very excellent work in early childhood with parent-child kinds of therapies are very well tailored because to treating tantrums and other things. I mean, one, you have to define what is the problem, right? Kid has PTSD, it's a different kind of treatment so you want to be targeting the treatment specifically for that person. And what's important with something like autism, because temper tantrums and aggression are a very big secondary symptom in autism, that can also be because the rate of anxiety is very high in children with autism, right? So that your intervention with children with autism may not just be focusing on the core symptoms of autism, but that you have to take into account that those tantrums may be related to fear and anxiety, and then focus more targeted anxiety treatments there. I think the main thing I'd emphasize in treatment of young children, you never treat a child out of the context and the relationship of his or her caregiving environment and caregivers. And that's you know, a really important point. And even in my assessments, I do a full, you know, screening with different screening measures for both parents of depression, anxiety, their parental stress level. And so often you want to intervene at the parent level, actually, because if you have a mom who's depressed, you're not going to make a heck of a lot of progress with that young child until you can have a parent who can be engaged, and unless you can find a substitute person who can do it. So it's, again, this very holistic view that it's never just the child, but it's the child in the family.
And I would add, it's the same thing with teenagers. You know, not just young children. It's the same thing with teenagers in the community and the same thing with teenagers in the hospital, that that tantrums or aggression is oftentimes contextual. It's transactional. It's occurring in the space between a teenager and the other adults in their life.
And it's also, you know, again, it's bringing sort of the careful approach of something like epidemiology or really careful clinical work, taking a temper tantrum and figuring out with the parent, okay, what triggered it? What happened before? What happened during? Like, even in my practice, parents sometimes will send me videos of the tantrum because kids never do it in your office.
Right.
So it's a helpful way to see that. But I think really doing a timeline
yeah.
and being able to understand that, you know, like a kid with ADHD who it's hard to get unstuck from his video game, and you say 5 minutes before bed, time for bed, get going, pull them out. Well, you can intervene, and then you're off to the you know the show with that. That you can say, okay, we're going to give you a warning. And so a lot of these pretty straightforward behavioral and parent-child kind of interaction therapies can be very, very helpful.
Great. Thank you.
Okay, so I'm now going to move to really the problem that has been uppermost in my mind for the last few years, really related to this idea that so few children who are in need get access to mental health care, and what are we going to do about that? So one of the key things in trying to address that issue with young children is you must do a multimodal assessment of a young child. Yes, we get information from parents. Parent report is critical and really, really important, but it is not sufficient. You have to do observational assessment. And this is here, this is actually from the slide here is from a book from my colleague Bob Emdy about the importance of observation, and it was true with Margaret Mahler and Renee Spitz and with the Stillface, that looking at a child's behavior and interactions with others enables us, that's really our only avenue into understanding the young child's emotional life. But the problem is that there are huge barriers to access. I mean, we, you know, again, have been saying that access to care starts with appropriate screening and diagnosis. I cut those out. But that here are the barriers. We do not have enough clinicians, and particularly those who are trained in observational assessment. The training is tremendously expensive and time-consuming. And so therefore, yes, something like the ADOS, which is the sort of gold standard in autism for observational assessment of children for autism, you'll get that in, you know, academic medical centers and then in sort of certain communities. But you really, if you're outside those communities, you won't get that. And let me just give you a number. I've now moved to New York from North Carolina. But in North Carolina, there are 100 counties. 70 counties do not have one child psychiatrist, much less a child psychiatrist who knows anything about infant mental health or preschool mental health. And so I've been working with my colleagues around this challenge of our current approaches just don't scale. We are never going to be able to meet this overwhelming need just in our country, much less in you know, low-resource countries that have even fewer resources. We're never going to meet the need. And this is where I have started this really exciting and wonderful collaboration with people in engineering and in software to think about how we can use information science and technology to create transformative solutions that can scale. And, you know, that's being done in all other kinds of industries, and we really need to do that in healthcare. And I'm going to show you now some of the data on how we're trying to do this. So I've been working with my colleague Guillermo Sapiro, who's an engineer in Pratt School of Engineering at Duke, to figure out how we can build a digital platform to advance early childhood mental health within a developmental epidemiology perspective. It's really like the next generation of developmental epidemiology. And here's a picture here of Guillermo and I, and I, you know, think it's, he's a very, very tall Uruguayan engineer, and I'm a very small child psychiatrist, so it's a fun, unexpected kind of collaboration. But the key here, and this is showing the team that I worked with at Duke and I continue to work with, that in order to do these kinds of new approaches, you have to put together very different kinds of teams. So yes, you need psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, pediatricians, engineers, mathematicians, software developers, and people also from different generational perspectives. You know, you need to have young people involved who are really living and their experience in this digital world is very different. And so this is just to show that the team we put together at Duke just ranged across the entire university. So the question we were addressing is, can we make digital tools that will use computer vision, and we'll be telling you what computer vision is, to automatically code a child's behaviors and emotion, taking into account we're never going to solve this with people. we have to figure out a way to be able to use technology to be able to substitute, not to substitute totally, but to support our human work. So next I'm going to show you a video from Guillermo's early work, and what I'm going to set it up because it's going to start. I'm just going to set this up in your mind. So this is an autism assessment. The video is blurry just for confidentiality reasons. It wasn't blurry like this. And what the examiner is doing is taking a ball and taking the ball from one hand and passing it across the midline over to her other hand. And the standard in the field is you're looking for the baby tracking that object, and the clinician counts 1/100, 2/100, and if the baby crosses the midline by 2/100, that's typical, and if it takes longer, that's it. So great, that's a little hard to, how do you write that down? How do you quality control? How do you check it? So what Guillermo and his team did is put a GoPro camera onto a desk and film the assessment. And what you see, this is from the film, that the computer algorithm automatically identifies the landmarks on the child's face and then identifies the object that's being tracked. And you see on the bottom, that curve there is the top one is one side, the left side. The midline line is midline when the baby is looking straight at the examiner. And then minus one is the other side. And you see here, yes, so this baby tracked at the midline after you know, it was like at 25 frames. I mean, so we have it on a degree that is so much more defined. But one, the clinician doesn't have to do the measurement. Number two, because we have so many frames a second, we're able to look at the slope of the attention, like how it tracked, how even it was, when the baby passed the midline. So this is an example of work that we then decided to apply in the area of mental health and emotions. So I think one thing I wanted to emphasize that I think is different about the work that that we are doing is that we kind of set out principles right when we started. And that, particularly in a new area, is really important because you have to really limit what you're doing and get good at it rather than to do the whole universe. And so here are some of the principles that we laid out, and the key things I wanted to highlight are two. Number one, we decided that our work was going to be built on tools that people have in their homes or their products. So we're not going to develop tools. These are great work that's being done with different sensors or things people wear or other things like that. That's great. That's just not what we do. And there are two reasons for that. One, from the beginning, we are building tools that are scalable, that can be scaled globally. And now the penetrance of smartphones, as Guillermo likes to call them, the supercomputer in your pocket, is incredible, I mean, across the globe. And so that is a tool that we then have to leverage. And then the last thing you'll see in the principles, it has to be beautiful and fun. Now that seems like a funny thing for a researcher and a doctor to say, but actually I'm really serious about this. And I hope that you'll see with the work I'm presenting that we've really taken this very seriously. Because the work that we've been doing in digital health, we have to use the same standards of design and beauty that are in the apps that everybody uses if we want people to use them. So if people are on their phone and they're checking Facebook and Instagram, and then they're like, oh, here's the kind of ugly, clunky, it doesn't load very fast, it's just kind of taking a rating scale and slapping it on, people are not going to use it. And then we're going to conclude, oh, people don't want to use digital health. Well, no. It's they don't want to use this one. And so this is, again, where working with designers is a fundamental part of what you are creating, because you're creating the experience. And also the form factor of a phone is very different than a computer screen or a piece of paper. The other piece here is just that the work we're doing is being developed for parents, for grandparents, for daycare providers, school. I'm really passionate, and we're passionate about getting these tools into the hands of parents so that they can go to the pediatrician, because what they'll hear often is, ah, wait 6 months, they'll grow out of it, it's a phase. And if you can say, no, actually, let me share this with you, and they actually have the evidence-based knowledge, I think that's going to change access.
Right, and just like in the 70 counties of North Carolina and many counties in New York State, there's no child psychiatrist available.
Absolutely, available. And this is where, of course, this connects up with our telepsychiatry initiatives, right? Because,
absolutely.
You know, and we're putting a huge investment in that in our department, yeah. And that's, so
and
this.
And there's a demonstration project that the commissioner started between OMH and our NYU department.
We've just hired actually a person to lead telepsychiatry who's coming from Pittsburgh who starts July 1. So yeah, so this is, I'm showing you this piece, but it has to be fit into, you know, many other ways so we can use the technology. So now I'm going to show you data from two studies we did. So the first one is called the PRIDE study. So in that one, this was sort of our proof of concept study. We went into primary care and tried to figure out how we could use automatic video observational assessment delivered with an iPad in the doctor's office to improve screening with the MCHAT, which is a parent report autism measure that is recommended by the CDC that be done with all children age 18 months and 24. However, kids who screen high on the MCHAT, which is a sort of select group, only half of those kids have autism. So if you think about the fact that we have very few autism assessment services, and we have a screener that will send, let's say, 10 kids
false positive.
With all of these false positives, and therefore that reduces access even more. So this is the more accurate we can be in what the problem is and send people to the right place, the better.
We're struggling with that with psychosis, those that are actually going to convert,
Even
if they have signs that are concerning.
Yeah.
Many will not go on to
exactly.
Are you going to put them on antipsychotics?
Well, so that's and ways that we could maybe also, yeah. I mean, I'm not talking about this here, but we're also working with other folks. I want you to do rapid clinical trials that you can use technology to maybe answer that question, like embed that in your practice and say, okay, here's our question. How are we going to try to answer that? So here is, up on the screen here is what we've been doing. So this is the iPad. So these are videos that we've used in our lab that we then put on the iPad. The child sits on the parent's lap, watches these videos, and then we use the front-facing camera on the device to record a video of the child watching these stimuli. I'm going to show you two examples. So here is this little girl, a typically developing girl. Our med student is behind her, and she's watching this pretty silly video that we did. And you can see not only that it's not just different emotions, but the complexity of her response to basically this social transgression, right? This, you know, knocking down the tower. Now, in comparison, of course, we have permission from the parents of both these kids to show these videos. Here's a child with autism watching the same video. And you see, first of all, he is not attending. He's not particularly interested. And then even when he watches, he has a pretty neutral, flat affect in watching the video. So we collect these videos and then apply these computer vision algorithms to, the algorithm identifies multiple landmarks on the child's face. We're just showing sort of the key ones, but it's actually over 200 landmarks. And then using what we know about how muscles change for different emotions, which is a very robust literature, we can automatically quantify the child's emotion as they are watching this video. This is actually one of our graduate students' kids who was watching this.
Of course.
Of course, of course. You got to bring the graduates, like I was a Margaret Mahler baby, right? You got to bring the kids in. So this slide here shows on the top with the line there is our comparison of reliability of the computer coding with human rating. And so you can see that we do a pretty darn good job. And then on the bottom, we just wanted to illustrate it so you could get a better sense of it. On the top is the computer coding, those little green and red boxes, and on the bottom is the human coding of the same subject. And so if your eye kind of scans, you can see the consistency.
Concordance.
Yeah. But the thing that is really also important to highlight about this is by having videos, yes, we can code for things that we know, right? But What about things that we may not have known or discovered before? And this is an example. So one of the paradigms we did is that a medical student who was standing before the child called the child's name. We did a number of trials for that. Because we know that children with autism are less apt to respond when their name is called than typically developing kids. And in this bar graph you see here, indeed, about 80% of the typically developing children turned when their name was called, and only 50% of kids turned. Now that confirms what has been shown in the literature, but that's not super useful as a screening test, right? Because you got 50% of the kids with autism who did turn. But on the other side, you see here that what we found is that the typically developing kids, the mean time it took them to turn their head to their name was 0.98 seconds, while the children with autism were slower to turn. It was a mean of 1.58 seconds. And so you can see the orange line are the typical kids, the purple line are the children with autism. But here's the thing. You cannot see that difference with the human eye. So I think this is to emphasize that the work that we're doing is not only to sort of give people access, but it's a way to gather data on a scale that we haven't been able to have about children to discover things about different groups of children that we didn't know.
This just really seems amazing. It's such a game changer in terms of having a different way of acquiring the information that we need to understand what's going on across a large population.
Well, and I mean, think we can talk about this. This happens to be in early childhood. We're working with folks at the VA at Duke on adults with PTSD. I just made an appointment with someone at NYU who does schizophrenia research. There's nothing specific to this that right. is young children. That happens to be what we do and tackling a specific problem, but it shouldn't be thought of as being something that could just be done with young children. So now I'm going to finish by sharing with you what came next was our second study called Autism and Beyond, and it's built on a platform that Apple released in 2015 to the research community. Well, to anybody, actually, to be able to do research studies fully contained within an app. So there have been, when it first came out, there's a Parkinson's study, there's a cardiac study out of Stanford, there's a breast cancer study, asthma, and Duke wanted to do an app, and we were fortunate to be selected as the group to produce Duke's first research kit app. And we were actually the first pediatric app also. Mm-hmm. And so the aims of this study were basically to do the similar approach that we were doing in the medical clinic, but there we had a medical student, it was in a medical clinic, and say, if parents are in their home, one, are they going to even be interested in participating in a study? So what happens is this app that we created, and I'm going to show you details about it, was up. It's on the app store in Apple, and so you would find out about it from various ways, download the app, get introduced to it, and then the consent is fully contained within the app, and I'm happy to talk about that and about the ethical issues and how we dealt with that. So then our question in this study is, would people download the app and participate? Part of participating in the app is agreeing to upload your video of your child, but we gave people a choice of uploading the entire video, which is more useful to us, or just the landmark information that I had shown you. So we were interested in what parents would choose. And then really, our people, if we just give them instructions on a phone, is the video they collect on their child going to be of good enough quality for us to be able to apply these algorithms? So we this was a study for children 1 to 6 years old. We had parent measures, and then we had 4 30-second video tasks. We had a bubbles, we had a bunny, we had sort of rhymes, a person singing nursery rhymes and toys, and then we turned the phone into a mirror so the child was looking at him or herself. And so that's what we did. And this is what the app looks like. So on the top corner, you see what we call the onboarding on the app. So here is sort of, oh, this is interesting. I downloaded this app. What is this about? And you can see the different examples here. What you don't see is we thought that people might be interested in downloading it just for the coolness of the face recognition thing. So actually, and if you download the app, you can see this. Without even enrolling in the study or doing anything, we have a thing that actually shows you. So you, it's a screen. Your face is on there, and then the landmarks are on there, and then the colors of the dots around your mouth and stuff change based on your emotions. So it's a, you know, you can play with it. We were like, okay, play, and then we'll get the people who actually want to be in the study. So as you can see on the top there, we used the same approach as we did with the iPad, that the child sits on the parent's lap, watches a video, and then we do quantification of emotion. We also do head orientation. The bottom corner shows you some of the consent screens. And then on the other side shows you, one, the tasks, so that list of tasks there. The one in the middle with the picture of the child on the parent's lap is an example of how that's how you have to explain things, right? Someone's not going to read through some really long thing about how to do it. So it's how to use different ways of communicating in more succinct and visual ways. And then on the far right is just two things I wanted to highlight, which is, number one, that we gave feedback. So parents, you could see as you go through the app how many other families were participating. But I also wanted to highlight two things about the feedback we gave families. So we did do the MChat screener for the kids who were in the range. We also did a temper tantrum screen that I've developed. And we did give people feedback from those. We decided in this case that it was ethical to do this around the MChat screener because it's freely available on the Autism Speaks website as well as other public websites. So we didn't feel like we were entering in a realm that was something that was only confined to clinical care. It's also, we could link people with care. But the other thing we felt like it was really important that the parents see the videos that were being uploaded, that we be as transparent as possible. So after you know, complete one of the video tasks, in that screen, you don't have to switch to it, on the right-hand side, you would see two thumbnails. You would see the video, you know, of the bubbles or whatever, and then the actual video of your child. Again, we really wanted to say, look, this is what we're uploading. Plus, in our consent, in most studies, if you decide to withdraw from a study, then any data that's been collected to that point stays in the study. That's kind of the standard in research. We did not do that. We said to parents, anytime, now, tomorrow, anytime you want us to erase all of the videos of your child, we will do that. So we really wanted to emphasize that. The other thing is, the other Research Kit apps actually were done with a third-party company, so the data was stored
on their servers.
Somewhere. Yeah. We've done all of our stuff behind Duke Firewall, and the work that we're building an app with Duke and NYU now will do the same. So at least at this point, we feel being able to say storage is happening, you know, at a completely HIPAA-compliant level yeah. is really, really important for people to feel reassurance. So here is a video, one of the real videos collected from the iPhone. I'm going to start it in one sec, but I wanted to point out the emotions are on the top there, but on the bottom where it says left and right, that's head movement. And so what you're going to see, watch out for a moment in this video when there's a positive emotion, the child has a happy emotion, which is in green there. Then when you see the child's head turn, you'll see that the screen is blank, and then he or she comes back to happy. That is an example of something that children with autism do less commonly than other kids, social referencing. So, oh, mommy, look at the bunny. Turn, say hi to mom, go back. And so this is just to illustrate how it's not only emotion or attention, but that we can combine these different parts of behavior to define more complex kinds of behaviors. Just the other thing to say is we can do blink rate, we can do pupil size, we can do other things. But here you see this video, and the key thing here is the quality of the video was amazing. So 90% of the frames we detected the child's face, so it, you know, shows that we're able to do that. So that was the social referencing there. Now, we, over the period of the study, which was a year, we had 1,756 parents who completed the whole consent process and at least one survey, skewed more towards boys because it was skewed more to kids with autism risk, and it's more common in kids, in boys. Over the study, we collected over 5,000 surveys. Parents completed about three of them, a mean. And then almost about two-thirds of the people decided to upload the entire video. And I think this is an important point here because in my area, parents of young children are young people who are growing up in a very, very different digital world and a different understanding about their about privacy and data and all these other things. So I think really thinking about what your audience is so important. And as I said, the quality was outstanding. And then we did look and see whether or not there were any differences in terms of emotion and attention. And in fact, we did see what we had hypothesized, which is that children with autism had higher rates of having a neutral, that kind of neutral, flat expression, less positive emotion specifically to looking in the mirror, and that is, you know, one of the core issues in autism is social relatedness, and so that was something we thought we would expect, and lower attention. So again, this is really a pilot study. Someone's going to ask, this is not a representative sample. It is not a representative sample. That is absolutely true. Yet, it is a large sample with very well-collected data. And just to put it in context, in the PRIDE study, over 2 years of data collection, we assessed 100 children. So that was our reach. So we're in the beginning of this work, but I think we're proving the feasibility and the value of this. So now, just want to say that we are fully engaged with many different child psychiatrists around the world. So we have partners in South Africa, Argentina, Turkey, India, China, and Singapore. These children here are from our pilot study in Khayelitsha Township in outside of Cape Town in South Africa. So our team and colleagues at Cape Town over 3 days went into Khayelitsha Township and we enrolled 50 children in autism and beyond, collecting videos. And this is so important, really, that it's not just access to care or access to knowledge. I actually think people having the opportunity to participate in research, because so many, even just in the computer vision algorithms, they've been trained on adults, and they've been trained primarily on Caucasians. So this gives us an opportunity not just to look at autism or any of these other problems, but to look at across normal development. How do we do the measurement of emotion? How are there differences in emotion or attention with age? And so that's what I'm so thrilled about, is really, I see this as the next generation in terms of epidemiology. And that really is the vision, that if we can collect data on this global scale with reliable, valid instruments, both data that we know is related to things, but also on the video level where we're going to get a more fine-grained data on many children, that not only helps us understand populations of kids, but it also is what is the key to true precision medicine and helping individual children. So this broad vision, as I kind of said in the beginning, is how we bring early childhood mental health, developmental epidemiology, neuroscience, engineering, and global health together to really see if we can come up with transformative solutions. And that's the work that you know, many things brought me to NYU, which is an amazing opportunity. And one of them is building this, what I call the global When to Worry platform. So we've done it with autism. Actually, the next app we're doing is Picky Eating, When to Worry Picky Eating, because that's an area we're moving into the sort of symptom level, not the disorder level. I've done a lot of work in that area, and it's an issue that a lot of parents worry about. And, you know, we're doing different approaches to that, but it's a very exciting opportunity. And it's not only bringing all, you can see the partners on that slide at some point, from across the medical center in with Duke, et cetera, but really it's an approach. I like to think of it as a citizen science, community science approach, because the only way this is going to work is if we fully engage parents, both in collecting the data and the information, but then it's not enough to say when to worry. What are you going to do about it, right? And so, you know, really being able to give evidence-based advice back. And so an example I can tell you of what we're doing for picky eating, which I think is really cool, is, you know, in picky eating, you define all these different foods that a kid will or will not eat. So we've made a game to do that. But then we're looking each food, and the food industry knows about this, not researchers, has all these different aspects. It's got different color and smell, but it also can be quantified by the stickiness on the roof of your mouth and other things like that. So we're taking each food and sort of defining all of its characteristics. Then based on the pattern of food that the kid will eat, we're using machine learning predictive analytics to suggest what is the different but closest get food exact to be able, so that with the idea that if children, instead of you're saying, oh, you only eat yogurt, and now you should eat broccoli. Exactly. Probably not going to work. But maybe if you go from yogurt to rice pudding to other things. Anyway, it's just an example of how we're trying to use these data to try to develop individualized kind of signature interventions for kids. That's just one example. So I can pause. I have sort of a few finishing thoughts that I wanted to give. Should I just go forward with that, or do you? Yeah, let me just finish up, okay, and then we'll ask some questions, because I think it's of a piece. So,
and we've got some questions that came out.
So I'm done, but I want to end with some thoughts that I think reflect the challenge of the work that I've laid out here, because it's exciting, but it's also big.
Okay, before you launch in, I'm gonna just open up the phone lines. So we hope you'll give us a call. Please remember to call from another room or turn down the speaker in the room so we don't experience the feedback. Our toll-free number here in Albany is 1-800-452-0662. Okay.
Great. Well, I labeled this last piece of my talk as seeing the lion. Well, what the heck does that mean? But it's really in sort of what the final thoughts I wanted to leave each of you with on this issue that I've been talking about for this whole talk about seeing things, but also being seen, which is really sort of the essence, and is the essence of our work as psychiatrists. So when you think about the word revising things, it comes from the Latin. It means to see again. And I do think that the work that I've laid out and the work that we do in many ways is we take a situation, an issue, and then how do we not just go along doing it the same way that we've done it? It's going to be the same clay in a way, right? But we say, how can we transform the way we see this to be able to come up with new solutions? And the way this really hit home for me was part of my opportunity to work in South Africa and go to visit Robben Island, which is where Nelson Mandela was imprisoned for so many years. So here is the picture of the flag that is on the boat, because you go from Cape Town to Robben Island, you take a boat there. And from Robben Island, you can see Cape Town. On the top there is the prison cell where Mandela spent many, many years. And then on the bottom is the lime quarry where the political prisoners moved lime from one side of the quarry to the other in the broiling heat. That was why Mandela had a lot of problems with his eyes, because the dust from the quarry hurt the tear ducts. And that little pile of stones in the middle there are, after apartheid ended, all of the political prisoners who had been kept at Robben Island, the ones who were alive, came and then did it for people who weren't. Each one of those stones represents a political prisoner who was spent time at Robben Island. So I had my camera and I took a picture here on the right-hand side, and the blue is the picture I took. But then when I got back from this trip, I found this picture that I had taken. Again, I didn't see it at that moment, sort of like with the video, it's at a flash that's higher than that. But this has had a lot of power for me because it looks to me like a lion, and it really represented the courage of Nelson Mandela in his situation, but also this idea of taking something that we see in one way, and it may be a terrible thing, like Mandela being imprisoned and how he was able to take that and keep hope and then lead his country, but how there can be sudden ways of seeing things anew that can also give us courage to forge ahead even when people tell you that it's not possible to do things. And so I'm just going to end with a quote from one of my favorite poets, Wallace Stevens, that for me really sums it up, and I hope it provides some of the inspiration for the work I'm doing, but really the work that we do every day. And here it is. After the final no, there comes the yes. And on that yes, the future world depends. And so I wanted to conclude with that because I think what I hope I demonstrated here is it takes a long time, you have to do different things, but we actually can make progress. And it is saying yes to trying new things and yes to finding new ways forward. So thank you. Yeah.
Yes.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Yes, we tend to live in a culture of no, right? And. Yeah. You know, even when I started in preschool mental health, people made jokes like, oh, what are you going to do? Put babies on the couch? You know, and the answer of my colleagues, if our data plays with the big boys, you're not going to, then that's how you answer it. You don't answer with, oh, you're being so mean or something like that. You answer with excellent science and excellent data.
Well, thank you. That was really tremendous and transformative indeed. I think that you can really, it's lovely to have someone like you sort of lay it out for us because it's extremely powerful, and I think people can see quite clearly the transformative power of that approach and kind of redefining our vision of what we, you know, the whole landscape really shifts.
Yeah.
So I want to get Bruce involved here because I'm sure he's got.
No. I think that whether it be, you know, the flag in the wind looking like a lion, or the information about these kids across the planet, with seeing them from a different point of view. I think that for me, that's the part that's really moving and opens up so much possibility in terms of our work as child psychiatrists and adult psychiatrists and mental health practitioners, you know, practitioners caring for kids opens up possibility. So creating a different point of view.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, that's really sort of the, when I'm using this metaphor of seeing is, once you know this, how do we not do something about it? That, I mean, that to me is part of where this is really a public health message, right?
Sure.
And
I mean, that's what Wallace Stevens was saying, right?
That's what he was saying.
That's what you're planning on, is that you can't, once you say yes, then
right.
then you have to redefine
exactly.
the world.
Right, exactly.
So.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So do you want to do any of the questions?
Yeah, well, I think there was obviously a lot of interest about apps, and you know, yours was the autism app was part of the research study, but this one came in from Josh Ayaden at NYCC Children's Center. And I think the question was, can you suggest any simple assessments that can be used by pediatricians to identify autism in early stages? So I think...
Yeah. Well, and I think this is really what we're trying to build.
Yeah.
And so, but I will say, you know, out of the work I presented you on the temper tantrums, I've actually developed a temper tantrum. It's a three-question screen. Does your kid have temper tantrums? Do they happen nearly every day? Does your kid hit, bite, kick, or break something? And actually, it's a very, very good screen for 87% of kids who are positive on all three. 87% have an impairing mental health disorder, mm-hmm. and it's about 90%+ of those who don't. So again, I think this is this area that I'm really interested in is how do we take these big, difficult assessments, which we should, you know, those are the gold standard, but how are we going to boil them down without taking away quality? Mm-hmm. And so that is where, like, we have a paper that came out recently where we looked at my old studies and did a machine learning approach, develop a new screen for anxiety disorders, a probability screen. Like, if you answered yes, your probability goes up. And at a certain point, you're already at 100%, so you can stop. So I think it's also, you're going to need different tools for pediatricians or daycare providers than you need someone who is then doing the assessment. Or the sort of the next level of screening is going to have to have a higher level of tools. But I think one of the things I'm pushing for at NYU is, how about if we kind of agree to use similar tools? Because everyone uses these different tools. And the World Health Organization has a whole initiative around open source measures. So I'm really passionate about creating measures that are freely available to the public, that don't cost a dollar to do each one. Because if you're building that in, you're limiting access. And I understand why people do it, but if our principle is to be able to get as many people as possible access to evidence-based issues, then we have to really think about those ethics. And I'm interviewing right now, I'm hiring in our department a full-time bioethicist who's going to be part of our department and working on our digital team, working more broadly, but specifically to address these ethical issues, which have to do with video and stuff, but also, what if you screen people and you don't have services for them? Is that ethical? Mm. I mean, it, you know, I mean, there are a lot of issues that we have to grapple with.
Yeah, and in all specialties, they grapple with that. Depression and primary care.
That's right.
We don't have, if you're in many parts of New York State or rural North Carolina, there's no psychiatrists or the mental health services are booking out 6 months.
But if we don't do it, then there isn't the recognition that it's a need. So it's
exactly.
And so I think it's how you engage with people and how you manage people's expectations. I think that's...
Yeah.
Particularly as we start on this work.
I think there's also some apprehension from the clinical community around being supplanted or a little bit threatened by technology in that sense.
Yeah.
And I personally don't see it that way because I see it like, well, otherwise they're not going to get any access. And the status quo is not really acceptable either.
And it's really, I see these tools as being what you do before the appointment. And then you're like, okay, I have these data, right? And then you synthesize that, and then you can talk to the person and integrate it and do what humans can only do. I think it's important. It's sort of a straw man to set it up as, it's sort of like robots are taking away jobs.
Yeah.
I mean, which are, they're meaningful issues, but it's really, I think, ultimately how we use technology to enhance what we do. And look, there are like, how many? 7,000 child psychiatrists in the United States. Most of them are in New York and Boston and California,
Right.
And in sub-Saharan Africa, where there are 400 million children, there are 56 child psychiatrists and 45 of them are in Cape Town.
Right. Yeah.
So I think for some of us, we can be sort of reassured like, okay, maybe this is for all the kids who aren't getting help, aren't seeing me now.
Right.
There's enough need to go around.
Okay. Jay, when you're talking about technology, I'm guessing you're not talking about stuff even as sophisticated as this. You're probably also talking about just regular video conferencing, what's now becoming a much more standard practice of using video conferencing for delivering psychiatric care.
Yeah, delivering psychiatric care, sort of apps that can treat depression or, I've had some good conversations with people. There was an MIT dissertation student who was trying to develop an app for basically crowdsourcing, had these people, the crowd was sort of trained on CBT and would recognize automatic cognitive distortion thinking and would feed that back to them. And And is this going to prevent people from getting going to see clinicians when they should? Is sort of the concerns that were raised.
I will say that what I feel proud about the work that we're doing is we've really grounded it in the best. You know, we're out of top child psychiatry academic departments, and all of the work that we're doing globally, we have partners
who are
clinicians and who are. You know, so that part of it is, what's the are we a trusted source or not?
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's see. Vlad Kananachuk from Queens Day Treatment Program said, in working with youth with developmental disabilities and autism, it appears that they may be more prone to become, he says, addicted to, obsessed with use of various technology. This then often leads to more serious problems such as school refusal, social isolation, sleep difficulties, etc. Given that saying no to technology is usually neither possible nor wise, how do you recommend approaching use of technology for young children with developmental disabilities?
I think that is an absolutely critical, really important question. And I think it's true for children with autism. If you go to any park today, you will weep, because there are the children playing on the playground and there are the grown-ups with their phones.
Yep.
So I'd say it's partly turning the mirror on ourselves.
Okay.
That we focus on, what should the kids' digital stuff? And it's like, how's that going for you?
Right.
You know?
And this is hitting a little too close to home for me. Because my daughter's soccer game, I sort of felt the urge to pull my phone out of the pocket. And I really had to rein myself in.
But I think, again, I think that's that piece of it. And these are very addictive and sticky. So I think this is an area in child psychiatry that's critically important for us to address. And young children should be limited significantly, not only because that's not how kids learn. I'll just say specifically around the work we're doing, ultimately I want to turn the camera. We're doing videos because that's where we're starting, because it's constrained, right? We know that they're all looking at the same thing. But ultimately I want to be able to film interactions
The
children are having, and we can do dyadic stuff and have it be as naturalistic as possible. So again, that's not having the child interfacing with the phone, but using that to advance it.
I think Matt Perkins also had a really good question about how can we more effectively use tablets and iPads in our state-operated treatment settings. And we're just about out of time, I would say. Any quick thoughts about that?
Yes, we should use them.
And Matt, you can talk to Dr. Egger.
And leverage people's own devices, not just think of it as devices that we supply.
Okay.
We could be using them for family meetings.
Okay.
With parents who can't make it into the hospital.
But we would, part of this is like, yes, and we all have to get together to figure these things out.
Terrific.
That's exciting.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, so I want to go to our take-home messages. So in conclusion, we offer the following take-home messages for clinicians. Number one, in pairing, psychiatric disorders start in early childhood. The rate of 1 in 9 is the same for preschool children, older children, and adults. Number two, all psychopathology is developmental. We must see the unseen. And number three, we cannot solve our access problems by building capacity alone. Technology paired with data science offers transformative promise. Helen and Bruce, I want to thank you very much for being on today's show. It's been a real pleasure.
I really appreciate it.
And to the audience, we value your opinion, so please take a moment to complete a brief evaluation for this Grand Rounds. The evaluation contains 5 multiple choice questions and 1 write-in question regarding how you'll incorporate the information from this program into your daily clinical practice. This was our last Grand Rounds for the season. Our annual CME planning meeting will be held on July 19th. We look forward to receiving your feedback regarding our recent programs and your recommendations for the coming year. We hope you enjoy your summer, and until next time, thank you for watching and be well.